So he's both the worst dog and the best dog in the world.
Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. To apologize to the members and the public for the delay, we were awaiting some audiovisual equipment for the presentations today. Before we start with the agenda, I wanted to mention for members about Monday's hearing. Monday, we are going to have a joint hearing with the Senate's Health Policy Committee regarding chemical in various products issues. And that will be a joint hearing with Senator Marty's Health Committee. What will happen with that is there will be two bills on the agenda, and then we will hear all the appropriate testimony for those two bills. But only the Senate Health Committee will be voting on those bills that day. And then the bill will be re-referred to our committee either immediately or at some point. And so this committee will have an opportunity to vote on it should it pass the Health Committee. But because we're having the joint committee and there are bills, and because of only one committee can vote on it at a time, after all the testimony and presentations are finished, only the Health Committee will be voting on those two bills at that time. I just want to, just for a process sake, I wanted to mention that. Any questions on that? So we'll move on to the agenda items. Today is an informational hearing on various lead bullet reports that have been prepared over the last year or so. The reason we are having this informational hearing is because there have been wide media reports as well as public discussion about the issue of lead in bullets and whether or not they have an impact on the on people, on animals, et cetera. There's been a lot of information swirling. What I want to do today for the Senate policymakers on this issue is to understand what recent reports have been prepared on the issue. That is not to say this is the entire body of knowledge on the issue, but there have been two reports on point on this issue that I think is important for us to hear. Understand and be able to ask questions on. The issue stemmed from Minnesota's creation of the venison donation program, but then there are other concerns that were raised, and so the DNR did a study on lead fragmentation. The Center for Disease Control prepared a report on the issue, although we don't have anyone from the CDC actually here to present their report. The Health Department, Minnesota Health Department, indicates they are well-versed on it enough to be able to present it to us, and hopefully they'll be able to answer all of our relevant questions. And then the Minnesota Department of Agriculture will give us an update on the status of the venison donation program. So with that, I believe Mr. Meyer will be introducing the report on behalf of the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for taking this opportunity to discuss this important issue. I just wanted to kind of frame where the DNR came at this report and why we did the fragmentation research. Last year, we were all well aware of the lead issue in the venison donation program, and we needed to do some research to figure out how vast that problem was and talk about just lead in venison to try to save, or so we can figure out how to move forward with the venison donation program, which we feel is a very important issue to provide that high protein food source for our food shelves. So that really focused on our work, and Lou Cornicelli, our big game program coordinator, will be presenting the findings. But you'll see here the reasons for our study was to gather information about lead fragmentation using common bullet types and firearms, that many people use in the taking of big game in the state. Discover bullet fragmentation tendencies, possibly allowing hunters and meat processors to minimize lead fragments when processing deer, and to provide study data and implications to hunters so they can make informed decisions when selecting bullets, which we did in the process of our hunting regulations manual last year. We've had some regional and nationwide meetings with our sister states talking about the issues that are out there and just talking about the issues in general, making sure that hunters are informed and that they're aware of the choices that they have. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to let Luke Corniselli present the findings of his study. Again, we looked at common bullet types that are available to people in the state of Minnesota that they are using in the taking of big game currently. Thank you.
Senator Chaudhry, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. Can you hear me okay?
No, you need to use the mic.
Mr. Corniselli, for the tape, we would appreciate you if you could speak into the microphone, either from sitting or if you...
Is this okay?
That works. So please introduce yourself for the record.
Lou Corniselli, I'm the Big Game Program Coordinator for the Department of Natural Resources, and I'm just going to, like Mr. Meyer explained, I'm just going to hopefully briefly go over the basic frameworks of our study results, and I do appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. As Mr. Meyer said, our results are preliminary, and we're still analyzing data, so some stuff might change, but it's pretty close. Our fragmentation information really just reflects general tendencies, and it's based on a limited set of circumstances. In other words, we were not able to use every bullet type that people use to deer hunt, nor are we able to recreate every condition. So we set a standards in order to measure. That way we can control one bullet versus the other. The bullets we chose are widely available in the state and just based on the projectile type and not the cartridge manufacturer. I'll get into that in a little bit of detail, but we chose a range of different manufacturers. The goal of our study was to document fragmentation. It wasn't a health study. We're not health experts. It's outside our area of expertise. And the Department of Health and the Department of Ag are also here today to show their point. And do their presentation. So mine's just going to be limited to what we found with our summer research project. We took, we selected five different rifle bullets. We chose a .308 caliber because it's pretty standard. On a scale, we used a bullet that expands rapidly. All the manufacturers load it. It's basically called a ballistic tip, but that's just the name. Everybody loads it. We chose a soft point, which is probably the most common bullet type, and for this exercise, we used a Remington Corlock. We used a bullet called controlled expansion, which is theoretically designed to not fragment, and that was made by Hornady. We used another lead-based bullet that's got copper in the front and lead in the rear. That was made by Winchester. And then the final bullet was a Barnes all-copper design, which is loaded here by Federal Cartridge. So we picked a range of different manufacturers for our testing, mainly on the type of bullet, not who loaded it. We also picked three other bullets. Probably a third of the state is in what we call the shotgun zone, so you can't use high-powered rifles. So we wanted to test some muzzleloader bullets because they're popular both for the regular season and muzzleloader season, and also a shotgun slug, which is just the old one-ounce slug that's been around since the 1850s. To get into the results, hopefully you can see this, and your color copies hopefully show some of it. The first bullet we shot was this rapid expansion ballistic tip, again designed to mushroom, expand, release all its energy quickly. And what we found is high fragmentation rates, and I'll show you a table later. It's kind of hard to see in a light room, but if you look here, all these little white flecks with the entry and the exit wound, these are all lead metal fragments, most likely lead. So high degree of fragmentation. Then we shot the controlled expansion bullet with a bonded lead core. That's the one that's not supposed to come apart nearly as much, but what we did find is that it did come apart. The jacket's a little thicker, and it's just supposed to peel back and hold most of its weight. What we found is it really didn't do that, and if you can see on this slide, we have metal fragments all the way back towards the last rib on this carcass. So even with a bullet that was designed to stay together, it really didn't in any of our cases. We also shot the soft point, the Remington Corlock. Again, this is a cheaper bullet that's made to mushroom, And what we found is basically those bullets came apart nearly as much as the ballistic tip and also this expanded controlled expansion bullet. We found metal fragments pretty well distributed throughout the carcass. And when I show you these x-rays, I didn't pick the best or the worst. I just picked one that kind of showed, you know, kind of showed what we were looking at. I could have easily picked any one of the soft points, and they really all looked about the same. I didn't pick, oh, this is the worst, so let's show this one. This is just kind of a representation, and mainly because the contrast was really good and I could see. Okay, then we shot the Winchester, which is a... it's a lead core bullet, but the lead is not exposed to the environment. And what we basically found was very low degrees of fragmentation. That bullet stayed together. And then finally, we shot the Barnes bullet loaded by Federal. It's called a Barnes TSX. What we found is virtually no fragmentation in this bullet. We had pretty standard entrance holes, pretty standard exit holes compared to all the bullets, but we found these bullets really just stayed together. They didn't come apart at all. So we did have this range of fragmentation based on bullet design, and that's kind of one of the take-homes. But this bullet probably performed the best with respect to expansion holes and weight retention. When we shot the muzzleloader bullets, we actually found a couple of different things. The one bullet that's made specifically for muzzleloaders, that didn't fragment at all in our testing. It stayed together really well. The other bullet is a pistol bullet that's widely used around the state, and what we did find is that did fragment quite a bit. Now, I'll get into it in a second. The fragments didn't go as far. There weren't nearly as many, but there are pretty significant differences between these two muzzleloader bullets. Again, that makes trying to make the point that fragmentation varies depending on bullet type. And then finally, the good old one-ounce shotgun slug, we found very little fragmentation. Again, here's an entry wound, here's an exit wound. We've got some, this is likely a bone or a meat fragment. We found very little fragmentation, and I'll get into it, but these didn't hardly come apart at all, both in weight retention when we recovered the bullets, and then pieces of metal in the carcass on x-ray. To summarize what we found, there's a lot of numbers here, so I'll just go through them rather quickly. Again, to make the point that it really, for a rifle, it really depends on what kind of bullet you use. Those ballistic tips, they fragmented on average. We were able to count 141 fragments in the 10. We wound up shooting 10 animals for each treatment, and I can go through the design. I didn't mention it because of the time, but if you want to talk about what we did for the study, I can do that. But the ballistic tip, we had upwards of 500 fragments in one carcass, which I wouldn't want to be the person who counted them, but we did find quite a lot of fragments. The soft point bullets were a little bit, and the bonded core, that Hornady that I talked about, they were about the same, even though they're about twice. The bonded core bullets cost about twice as much. Their fragmentation was about the same. The enclosed core bullets did fragment a little bit. That was all copper. And then the full copper bullets, they didn't really fragment at all. We found a flake of metal or a petal might have come off one or two, but we really didn't see much fragmentation at all. So there's this big gradient within. Remember, these are the bullet weights are the same. The gun's the same. It's just simply the bullet type. All the animals were shot behind the shoulder in the same spot. So this is again, description of bullet performance. Again, the shotgun slug, we did have one slug that came apart, but on average they really didn't. And then the muzzleloader bullets fragmented quite a bit. One of them did, the other one didn't quite a bit. One of the points that we hear a lot is that I trim a couple inches around the carcass, so therefore I don't have a problem. So what we decided to do was we overlaid a 4-inch circle over the exit wound. So in other words, we went 2 inches from the outside margin of the exit wound, and we counted the fragments. That we counted total fragments, and then we counted percent numbers of fragments within that from 2 inches around, figuring that's about as far as people are going to trim. And what we found is that by trimming that radius, you get less than half the fragments. We found that in the ballistic tip, you only get you get less than a third of the fragments. Now, obviously, with the copper and the bonded bullets, you get the where no lead's exposed, you get more because they're not breaking apart. But some of those pieces are going a little bit further, but they weren't lead. But so the take home for this was that what we found is even if we trimmed out a radius, we were still getting we were still getting a significant number of fragments. So then, what we looked at. Oh, that's weird. I apologize. I didn't transcribe very well. Then what we looked at was how far did these fragments go? And the interesting thing with this, and when you do any kind of a research project, you make your best hypothesis as to what you think you're going to see, and you do it. Well, the X-ray machine, the way we had to do the shoot the carcasses with the X-ray was that we had to take two for each animal. So we tiled the images together. And we thought that if we went from the neck to the hip, we'd catch everything on two X-rays. So the maximum we could detect any fragment was probably around 14 inches, which is also, ironically, almost the maximum for a couple of these X-rays. So the take-home for this is we didn't go out far enough. We probably would have found fragments had we taken X-rays wider across the carcass. So the fragments are going a long way. And what illustrates the point about maybe having to go a little farther on X-ray is because we also took meat samples from 2, 10, and 18 inches away from the exit hole. And in the case of the ballistic tip bullet and then also the lead core bullet, we found detectable lead levels at 18 inches. So even though our X-ray only went out 14, when we took a core meat out, we still had a couple hits of detectable lead. So obviously if we had gone an X-ray out an extra 4 inches, we probably would have seen those fragments. So they went a lot further than we thought they would. On this, the Winchester and the Federal loads, they didn't fragment much, so therefore there's really no distance for those fragments to go. The shotgun slugs and the muzzle loaders, they did fragment a little bit, but they're going so slow that we weren't finding lead very far out from the hole. So they're coming apart, but the trimming thing might make a little more sense with those slower moving heavy bullets. Sweet. The other thing we did, and this data that I'm going to show you now was not used in the analysis. We had a few extra animals, and we decided to play around or test some fragmentation on not-so-ideal shot placement. What we were hearing from the processors is that, you know, we did the best we could, but a lot of these deer come in really shot up. And so you're finding lead because we're trimming the best we can, but we're trying to take care of it. So we said, all right, well, let's shoot a few animals in the hind quarter to see what happens. So we picked three. We picked the soft point, the ballistic tip, and the shotgun slug, which are probably the three most popular for deer hunting, and we shot them in the hip. And what I found on the ballistic tip is that on this, if you know how to read X-rays, we wound up hitting the femur on the entrance and also hit the femur on the exit. So you could argue that as soon as the bullet hit the femur, it exploded, and that's why there's so much lead. But what we found is, remember, also the viscera is removed, so there's no intestinal, colon, bladder. This is all gone. So some lead went out with the when we eviscerated the animal. But what we found, if you can see it, is pretty much lead particles on both hams. So when we broke that femur, we did distribute a lot of lead. So on the next one with the soft point, as luck would have it, not by design, I actually missed both femurs on this shot. So this was just the bullet going through. And we saw basically the same thing. That's the entrance, and there's some lead there. There's some lead here. Remember, this is all gone in here, so that's why it doesn't look like a funnel. And then here's all the lead fragments that we found on the other side of the leg, even without hitting bone. So these hind quarter shots, there was quite a bit. Conversely, on the shotgun slug, again, I just so happened to hit the femur on this, but it didn't hardly fragment at all, which kind of lends back to our behind-the-shoulder shots. A little bit. See, there's some here. There's some here along the bone, but generally you're not seeing this in the shotgun slug. So in conclusion, I think you have it. We did develop 9 tips for hunters that we did distribute prior to the deer season. We feel that selecting an appropriate bullet design is really the best way to manage the fragmentation. Certainly practicing good shooting to get cleaner, closer, better shots, we always would recommend that. We found that the hindquarter shots really left a significant number of lead fragments, even when they didn't strike bone. We found lead a lot further from the wound channel than we thought we would, and so we were not able to make a recommendation for how far you should trim. We can't say go out 16 inches, because then you're really left with a neck and a tail. So so we couldn't make that recommendation. We can't say that if you go out 4 or 6 inches, you're going to get all the fragments. You're probably not. depending on the bullet that you use. I didn't get into it, but we actually did some pre-rinse and post-rinse x-rays, and what we found was that when you rinse the carcass, you didn't decrease the number of lead fragments, you just spread them out further. The number went down a little bit, but we started to find them further back. The x-ray pictures I showed you were all pre-rinse, so we didn't wash it out and then take the x-ray. That was all pre-rinse photos. The particles that we were finding are likely too small to really detect. You know, we were picking them up on x-ray, but they're pretty small. And I don't think that goes back to the trimming thing. If you hunt, you know to look for blood streaks, and you look for fragments, and you know to trim that. But these fragments are pinhead size, so you're just not going to see them. We didn't find lead in the enclosed lead core bullets or the copper bullets. We found nothing. And I repeated myself. I do that sometimes. We developed 9 tips. But the take-home for us, and I think hopefully we made this point in our work and in our message, is that hunting's important in this state. You know, we have 500,000 deer hunters. This year we harvested almost 222,000 deer. It's part of our heritage. You know, it's part of our families. It's our future. And hopefully nothing in this study suggests otherwise. You know, our goal was merely document fragmentation and give folks a sense for what's their risk. If they're not worried about it, there you go. If you are worried about it, there you go. We didn't make recommendations. We didn't tell people what to do. We really just wanted to describe, and hopefully that's all we've done. And I think that's it. And I can certainly answer any questions, or Mr. Simon can, or Mr. Meyer.
Questions for Mr. Carnicelli?
Thank you.
One question I had is, let's just say you trim out 2 inches, which has been customary. Your study indicated that there will still be fragments. Was there a difference in size of the fragment as you moved farther away from the entry or exit wound?
Mr. Chair, we didn't measure actual fragment size. We measured just numbers and distance. But physics would certainly dictate that a smaller, faster-moving object is going to go further than a slower, larger piece. So I would suspect that would be the case, but we did not measure that.
Okay. So when we're saying you had made some reference to pinhead size fragments. When you're saying fragments, is that generally what we're talking about in terms of what is within 2 inches or outside of 2 inches?
I think it's highly variable. If you look at this x-ray, there's a small piece right here, but there's a fairly large piece right here. So it probably matters more what is that fragment hitting on its way to where it's going to stop. Is it going to go through the stomach or the diaphragm, which is everything's going to slow it down, or is it going to go through an open, you know, some open space and then stop? So it probably depends on the physiology of where it hits and what it's doing at the time. So I don't know if you could predict that you'll get 80% of the bigger ones if you go 4 inches out. I can't answer that.
Then just help us visualize what is what's a fragment. Is it, in general, what does a person visualize in terms of a fragment? You said pinhead for some. What should we visualize when we think of fragment?
I guess I would think functionally what I could see, and I'm not so sure you can see a lot of these on just examination or as you slice through the meat. So certainly something like this might be noticeable, but something like this probably isn't. If you have one here that you notice as you're cutting through, you pull it out, but you get that big one, but have you missed 8 smaller ones that are around it? So a fragment, I would think, is one that you can see. And remember, the x-ray is going to pick them up probably better than your eye is because it's looking for that contrast. So we saw a lot of fragments at varying distances that I'm sure the eye wouldn't see. And when we met with the processors, they all agree that, yeah, I wouldn't have seen that.
Outside of the 2 inches you described, as they're some of these fragments are spreading out, are they necessarily, or was there a likely place in the anatomy where they would be? Do they spread? Are they more likely to spread into the guts, or are they spreading into the meat? Is it when they're going outside of that 2 inches? Is that necessarily or likely place that someone would eat?
My answer would be it depends. I suspect it's highly variable. And again, these were quote unquote perfect shots behind the shoulder with the front shoulder pulled away. So this probably doesn't really represent the average moving deer. I've got 2 seconds to shoot. So there's too many variables to answer that question. I would suspect they're going to fragment and go whichever way they go.
Okay. So the percentage outside of the 2 inches could be in places where you'd eat. It could be places where they would be removed after you field dressed it.
Correct. And these, important to note, is that we shot the animals with the viscera intact, and the x-rays were taken with the hide off and the viscera out, because we were trying to simulate what would a hunter see when he or she brought that animal home. And we didn't, you know, the x-rays weren't taken with the, you know, with the heart and lungs in, because that would have biased towards more fragments, because some of them obviously are going to be in the internal organs, and they're going to be removed and discarded. So ours is this will be fragments in the meat, in the either in the rib cage or in the shoulder or in the hind quarter. So this is not representative of viscera.
All right. Senator Anderson, you have a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was really similar to what you were asking about the size of the fragments. I was just wondering if maybe there's fragments that are smaller than we can see on the X-ray, and, you know, could you test for those through testing for lead content, for example, if they were lead? And what amount of a tiny size would it take to actually create a level of lead in a human who ate it? Do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, no, I don't. But Dr. Kastenberg and Dr. Kneeser are here. They could probably speak on X-ray technology better than I could, and the health impacts. Mr. Stein and Dr. Zabel are here as well, so they'll address that, I think.
I had a lot of health impact studies as well. I think I was saving them for the health department, but certainly Mr. Cornicelli can answer something, that would be great. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your study here, did you consider it all, or maybe that's for a different day, the shocking power of these bullets, one versus the other, as far as killing power versus lead versus copper? Lead, of course, having fragmentation, and copper with none. Is there more of a killing power with a lead bullet versus copper bullet?
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we kind of did in our report. We looked at entrance hole and then exit hole to get an idea of what, you know, how much energy is being lost and how much is being retained. We did collect all the bullets with a sand trap, which isn't the best way to do it, but it was the only cheap way we had. So we did find that the ballistic tip bullet lost all of its lead core. That was dumped out either in the sand or in the body. Obviously, the Barnes Federal bullet, that retained almost all of its weight. So you do lose some of that energy from the lack of fragmentation. But the exit holes that we measured weren't any different between bullet types. So I think the killing power is probably comparable. For a deer doesn't probably know the difference is the take home. It's just the Barnes bullets didn't come apart like the soft core bullets did. But they all went through. Every single bullet we shot went completely through the carcass. We were able to recover them all.
Follow up.
Thank you. And the shotgun slug versus the core or copper core or copper covered bullets, obviously the old shotgun that you talk about from the 1800s that everybody still uses, those that know, it is just a big lead ball that gets thrown at the deer. Very little fragmentation.
Correct.
That's due to lack of velocity?
It's mostly, yeah, I'm sorry, Senator Ingebrigtsen. It's likely due to the weight of the slug and then the speed that it's moving, which is slow. It doesn't have the ability to really come apart. We saw a little bit, again, but not much relative to the high-powered rifle bullets, which makes intuitive sense.
Just to clarify what animals you were testing this on?
Mr. Chair, we used freshly euthanized domestic sheep. That was the easiest and cheapest thing to get our hands on. July is not a good time to get deer, and we weren't able to control those variables. So we got a hold of sheep that were going to the rendering plant anyway, and then the farmer euthanized them, and then we did our experiment within a couple hours of them being expired. So, but we shot each animal at 50 meters from a rest behind the shoulder. So, we just tried to control it as best we could, knowing we can't describe everything.
These were already dead.
Yes, sir. Yes, they were already dead.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that there's going to be a another contractor that's going to be utilized by the state for the TB issue up in northwestern Minnesota. And this year they're not going to be using lead-based bullets. Are you going to do any studying, any follow-up with that at all on-site? I mean, is that something that's needed, or do you see any use in that when you're talking about the issue here at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I've not been involved in that contract, but Dennis may have a little bit of information on what we're doing. Does that, Ed, do you know? I'm not involved in the sharpshooter contracting.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the DNR, and the contractor for the ground sharpshooting is Wildlife Services with USDA, and they have been our contractor for TB for several years. We didn't make it a requirement of the contract, but they decided to use non-lead bullets this year. We then were in the process of awarding an aerial shooting contract, and we did make it a requirement of that contract that they use non-lead bullets. The reason for that is we're distributing those carcasses for food, and we just thought rather than having questions about whether people getting those were going to be ingesting lead, that we would go to that non-lead bullet. But we're not planning any further radiographs, x-rays, or other studies of those. I think with what Mr. Corricelli presented, the copper bullets, really, we don't think we'd have any different results with those on sharpshooting than what we've seen on this study.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what was reported to, I'm not sure, this committee, or maybe it was the Ag Committee last week, was that the, I believe it was the Ag Committee on the TB study that was done, there were, in fact, lead bullets used this last year with the contractors. And there were X amount of carcasses that were killed. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it was the Ag Committee, and that's correct.
Thanks.
Further questions for Mr. Conicelli, the department? Hopefully they'll be able to stick around, and after the presentations we can have a more free-flowing discussion. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda is John Stein from the Minnesota Department of Health. And Mr. Zabel as well. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Linkstein, the Director of Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. Joining me today is Dr. Eric Zabel. He's an expert on lead and lead contamination, lead exposure in Minnesota's human population.
Linkstein?
Link. John Link. It's my middle name.
Oh, I'm sorry. John Linkstein. Okay.
Yeah, that's my mother decided that. I'm told.
No quarrels with your mother. No, trust us.
I just
wanted to make sure we were clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
John Linkstein. The lead has been known for quite some time to have toxic effects, especially sensitive to children and developing fetuses. Toxicity concerns about lead led to a number of things being banned from use. Lead in gasoline, residential paint, solder for plumbing, and water pipes. The efforts of the federal government, many and all states and local jurisdictions around the country have led to numerous lead poisoning prevention programs being implemented across America, and that has dramatically reduced children's lead exposure, a very successful program over the last 20 years. Children are vulnerable, more vulnerable to lead poisoning than adults. And children are at risk because they're still developing their brains. So the most significant concern for lead exposure is developmental effects in the neurological system of the brain. And that, for that reason, the health department has a special concern over exposure to pregnant women and children under the age of 5. The CDC study that we provided a copy for the committee today was a study that was conducted in North Dakota this last year in 2008. There were 742 participants in that study.
Is this the October 14th, 2008
yes,
memo?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. It's okay. October 14th and was authored by an epidemiologic intelligence service officer that works for the National Center of Environmental Health. And
the National Center for Environmental Health is part of the CDC?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And the study interviewed and also took blood samples with informed consent from these 742 participants. The participants were recruited from 6 cities in North Dakota, Bismarck, Fargo, Grand Forks, Minot, Jamestown, and Dickinson. And those individuals were sampled during May. Their blood was sampled during May of 2008, and the sample results are reported in this study. Some of the conclusions and the results you can read on pages 5 through 8, but I'll just highlight a few notable items from there, and then we're happy to answer questions about this study such as we can. But essentially, there were only 5 children that were sampled in this study out of 742 participants. The vast majority of those sampled were fairly well-educated, Caucasian. Men were overrepresented compared to women slightly. There was evidence of recent wild game consumption as part of the general statement in this results that a number of the participants, I believe over 80%, said that they were consumers of wild game, and that there were a range of levels reported of blood lead, lead in the blood. There's overall a very low finding of blood lead results, 1.1 microgram per deciliter of blood, which is very similar to the national average for blood samples taken of adults. That's taken by the CDC in what's called the National Health and Nutrition Evaluation Survey. That's a study of about 4,000 individuals that's conducted by the CDC every 2 years to look at the exposure to chemicals and contaminants in people. There were some results that indicated slightly elevated blood lead levels in the participants of this study. Some that were over 5 micrograms per deciliter, but there were no results showing elevated levels over 10 micrograms per deciliter of blood, and that's the intervention level at which the federal guidelines require lead prevention programs to intervene. If there's a result that we have a lead screening test that's required at birth and at young stages of life, and if there's a child that's blood lead level that's reported greater than 10 micrograms per deciliter, we're required to intervene and interview the family and try to reduce that child's lead exposure. The vast majority of childhood lead exposures come through paint that was used in older homes prior to 1979. When paint dries and chips, forms dust in the home, and children ingest that dust by playing and sometimes directly eating the paint. That's the majority of the way that children are exposed or in the soil surrounding the home. So this study found essentially comparable results in the population surveyed, but I would note that the survey was somewhat limited in sampling of children. We'll come back to that study in responding to your questions. Dr. Zabel and I can certainly do that. I also wanted to let the committee know that we found the health consultation that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry conducted in November of 2008, responding to the question from the state of Wisconsin about the potential for ingestion exposure to lead fragments in venison in Wisconsin. This report is what's called a health consultation, and this government agency responded to a request from the state of Wisconsin for this consultation.
Could you repeat what that report is again?
This is it's called a health consultation, the potential for ingestion exposure to lead fragments in venison in Wisconsin, November 4th, 2008. By the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, and we can certainly forward to the committee administrator electronic version of this.
So this was an additional report that was requested by the state of Wisconsin?
Correct.
From the, is this the CDC as well or some another?
The agency for, Mr. Chair, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry is a joint agency. It works in part for the Centers for Disease Control and in part for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay. All right.
So there's a shared funding relationship, and they're somewhat independent.
Okay. Right. So not exactly the CDC, but something similar.
They're closely affiliated with.
Closely affiliated.
Yes. Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair.
So Wisconsin requested some information from this organization, and that's the report that you're referring to now?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right.
The consultation does not sample any human beings in Wisconsin. It merely looks at existing data and other information relative to lead exposure and consumption of venison. And I would say that my assessment of what they gave advice to the state of Wisconsin was fairly similar to the advice that was given in Minnesota for venison consumption from donations at food shelves. And I think that might be informative for members of the committee to read as well.
Okay.
Having said that, this past year during the discussion of concern over lead fragments found in venison at food shelf donations, we were asked to provide health-based advice, and our advice was that children under the age of 5, pregnant women, should avoid the risk of exposure to lead by avoiding consumption. That advice was carried out in a variety of ways by notifications on packaging, by public information campaigns that state agencies conducted, ourselves as well as the Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. or the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So, in conclusion, our health-based advice is to limit consumption of lead fragments in meat for children under the age of 5 and pregnant women because of the increased risk to the neurological system during development. We've been consistent in giving that advice. That does not translate into regulations in our state. That is advice. And with that, Dr. Zabel and I are here to answer any questions you have.
What remind me what percentage of the North Dakota sampling had the, was it the 5 micrograms? What's that, the unit that you use?
Micrograms per deciliter. It's a measurement of mass per volume. It's a mass of the lead per volume of blood.
All right.
And Eric, do you know the answer to that? The percentage of those that were greater than 5 micrograms per deciliter?
Mr. Chair, I can see here that.
Please introduce yourself for the record, since this is the first time you're.
Eric is. Zabel with the Minnesota Department of Health. And I can see here that they stated that 1.1% of the P people in the study did have a blood lead that was five or greater.
Okay, thank you. The North Dakota study for either of you, as you indicated, had comparable results of lead levels with the rest of the population at large. How did you then make the determination that there was an increased risk to children and pregnant women?
Mr. Chair, our response on that is based on just longstanding knowledge of childhood lead exposure risk and numerous other studies that have been done looking at neurological effects and developmental effects on laboratory animal studies for lead exposure. So because we are applying what we would consider precautionary principle in addressing the potential risk, we simply took the premise that if there's a risk of increased exposure, because we can't control for other exposures, such as lead paint chips, lead in plumbing, lead in drinking water, et cetera, that the prudent thing to do was to be precautionary and advise to avoid that exposure because it is an avoidable exposure.
Okay. Thank you. Does the health department have knowledge about whether about the differences? Are there differences in types of lead and toxicity, whether it be in lead in paint or lead in pipes or solder or lead in bullets? Is lead the same throughout, or it's all have some sort of lead, base, but is it the same stuff in paint, pipes, or bullets? And if there's a difference, what is it?
Mr. Chair, there's no difference. The pathway of exposure is ingestion. We're exposed to lead by ingesting it. The risk, the ingestion, or the exposure risk, and the pathway of risk is by consuming it. So water-based, paint chip-based, fragments of lead that might be in meat, there is no difference. Elemental lead is the cause of risk and concern.
Okay. So whether
Dr. Zabel would like to contribute as well.
Mr. Chair, the form of lead that causes most of what we know as its toxic effects is the plus 2 ionic form, and that is the form that is found in paint, and that form is frequently found in soil, because that's the form that the lead that was in gas, if it's exposed to the sun and when it's burned, it gets turned into it. The form, obviously, that is in a bullet or a fragment is pure elemental lead, which on its own, we would say that is not responsible for the effects of lead. However, once that solid lead is ingested, the stomach acid is at a very low pH, and that dissolves the solid lead and turns it into the toxic form, which is then absorbed.
Okay. You're saying that the stomach acid in the case of bullets is what then converts it to that plus 2 ionic
Yes.
Okay. Further questions for the witnesses? Senator Scogin, then Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just back to the microgram per deciliter. In your North Dakota study, they were pretty average to other Americans. So there was really no indication that eating wild game changed that percentage much?
Mr. Stein.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, excuse me. There was a slightly elevated, I'm looking for the quote from the study, but it
John, if you would like.
All right, Dr. Zabel's got it. There was a slightly elevated incidence.
Mr. Chair and Senator, what they had found that there was a statistically significantly higher level of lead in the blood of the people who did eat venison as compared to those that didn't not. It was, I believe they said, 0.3 micrograms per deciliter greater, which is a very small amount. So what basically they found is that the consumption of venison did appear to be associated with a higher level of lead in the blood, but it's not a very big increase.
Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair, on a follow-up to this point, did you ask, had they eaten other wild game? Or were you just asking about venison?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, no, the report clearly states it was all forms of wild game birds. Anything taken as wild game, it was inclusive in their study.
Senator Scogin.
And then, Mr. Chair and Senator, I would just add that they did include all forms, but they did ask separate questions. So they actually did have a separation of who ate venison as compared with birds and both.
Mr. Chair, just
go ahead.
Are we heading in a direction like the recommendations on fish consumption, where wild game would be recommended not to eat more than so many meals a week?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin,
are we there already?
No, we're not there. We give similar advice relative to exposures to other environmental contaminants without establishing what you would consider like a fish consumption advisory. This is, I would call, some of the first work that's been done on looking at the association between hunted sources of meat and blood lead. Certainly, from the health department's perspective, wild game is a very, very valuable source of protein, low-fat protein, that is an important component of a healthy diet. So before we go down that path of discussing consumption restrictions or advisories, we want to carefully consider the dietary benefits of consuming low-fat protein like hunted game.
I guess that gets a bit, kind of a question. Does the
benefits
has the health department made any precautionary principle advisories on the consumption of fatty acids in other types of meat?
Mr. Chair, no, we've not.
Senator, Senator Ingebrigtsen, you had your hand up, then Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is we consume the lead. We were able to understand that. We know it's not good for us. What's the final outcome of those that consume lead? Maybe you talked about that, or what did the study show? Children versus, and I know that's certainly high risk for children or pregnant women, but these folks that have been living around, at least in my district for years, shooting and consuming with lead over the years, when they hear this, they say, you know, here I am, I'm still here. I'm in pretty good health. What's the final outcome? What are we looking at here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm not sure that there have been any conclusive studies on that, but I'd ask Dr. Zabel to comment on the adult exposures to lead and what they've been found to cause in terms of demonstrated effects in adults.
Mr. Zabel.
Mr. Chair.
Zabel, excuse me.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, lead is interesting because it can have a real wide range of effects depending on the amount. So for children, if they're exposed to a very high level, that can actually be fatal, as we saw in 2006. But as we get down to the lower levels, some of the effects that have been studied and seen on a population basis are decreases in IQ and possible behavioral problems, and there are other effects on biochemically. And one thing is that some of these effects in children aren't necessarily seen right at the time that they're being exposed. Most of the data on children is looking at them being exposed at age around age 1 and age 2, and then looking at what effects they see as they get older. Now, for adults, some of the effects, it's similar to children in that adults exposed to a very high level can have very overt symptoms. But as you get down to more moderate or lower levels, what has been found that has actually been associated with increases in blood pressure and also effects on the kidneys. And so and when I say kidneys, it's some reduction in the function of the kidneys. And so these are effects both in adults and children that we are not expecting to be fatal, but they are still having an effect. And they are effects that might not always be identified at first as being lead.
Okay.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you both for being here, and I'd just like to take the opportunity to commend you for the good work on the peanut outbreak that has consumed the nation now. I think it's a real credit to the Department of Health that outbreak was first discovered here in Minnesota, traced back to the peanuts, and I think it speaks to the strength of the department in that way. So I have a question about the guidelines for young children and pregnant women not consuming venison or wild game that may contain lead. So I understand that you have a public health campaign to try to limit the exposure, and I was thinking about, I volunteer, or used to more, at our local food shelf where they would hand out venison just wrapped in paper and it was frozen, and I don't remember seeing any advisory that would go to the families to make sure that they don't give that to their real young kids. So I'm wondering what efforts specifically related to food banks that you can do.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, I am going to allow that question to go to the Department of Agriculture, because the food shelf program and meat that's there is their responsibility. So There have been recent efforts to improve notification for recipients of donated venison. Don't know when you volunteered, if it was recent or not, but I defer that to the Department of Agriculture for their response.
Further questions for the witness? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask a peanut question?
By all means.
Or a peanut butter question. In the reporting that at least the that I saw, it said that the company that was providing or making the peanut butter had identified salmonella a year before it was ever caught or any incidents. What happened in there in terms of I mean, it would have been much better if they would have protected or prevented that ahead of time than to, you know, allow that to affect, you know, hundreds of thousands of people.
Mr. Chair, Stein. Senator Stumpf, Dr. Heidi Kassenborg from the Department of Agriculture knows the answer to that question much better than I. So I'm going to defer to her, let her come to the table and answer that.
More questions on the science of lead and the actual the studies on the bullets. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask, what is the meaning of and the connotation for the, and I don't know what to call it, it's just a notation in this study dated, it says October 14th, and it's capital P, small b, and capital B, but I don't see it defined any place in there. What is that? Is that a scientific formula, or is that an acronym for something that's standard in sciences that are research type?
So what page are you referring to?
It says seven. Page seven. Well, it's on several pages, but seven is
okay.
Is what I have open right now.
Capital P, lowercase b, capital B.
Right.
Okay.
Dr. Zabel can answer that, but PB is the, if you remember your
elements?
Your elements, your periodic table of elements, PB is the
anymore.
Is the symbol for lead,
okay.
And PBB must be the laboratory analysis or form of lead that they were looking for, I'm guessing. Dr. Zabel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, that simply here just means blood lead.
Okay. I wondered if it had that.
I would... As a scientist, I would take issue with them also if they did not spell that out.
Thank you. I just, you know, it's been about, I don't want to say 50 years since I studied the elementary and had them all memorized, including their valences.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I guess that I have a comment and then a question. It would seem to me an easy way to know you don't have lead in the venison you shoot is to not use lead projectiles to shoot a non-lead bullet. And you'd know there's not lead in. The other question I have goes back to some quotes from the North Dakota study where they included individuals who consumed all types of game. Is there any evidence that we receive lead from upland game like pheasants, mourning doves, partridge, where we use a very small shot to harvest the birds and that ultimately gets ingested?
Dr. Zabel.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Frederickson, yes, there actually have been quite a number of studies looking at lead exposure from birds as opposed to venison. So on that issue, there actually is a lot more data. And some of the studies would show that birds that are shot with lead shot, if they are consumed on a very frequent basis, would lead to elevated blood lead. And some of these studies indicate that even if the visible shot pieces are taken out, they still saw some potential for exposure.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
Chairman, Dr. Zabel, it wouldn't be too much trouble. Would you forward a website to us, to the committee, so we could look at some of those studies, please?
They will do
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, yes, I can forward you either all the some of the individual papers or some of the summary information that I have.
Thank you very much.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. You tested humans, the blood. Do you test any meat at the department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scogin, no, we do not.
Okay.
Further questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much. Oh, excuse me, Senator Anderson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure, and I apologize. I've been in and out a little, but I don't think you said. Can you tell me what size of a piece of lead it would take to have harmful effects, or is that too hard to answer? I mean, does it depend on a cumulative amount?
Dr. Zabel. Mr.
Chair and Senator Anderson, overall for lead, the amount of it that it takes to cause an effect depends on a lot of factors. Some of them are what age the person is, because young children tend to absorb lead a lot more easily. It also depends on what other food they are eating at the same time and what their overall state of health is. Those are some of the reasons that we have not come out with any level that this amount is safe and this isn't. And one thing more I should add is that for all of these effects, actually, it has never been demonstrated that there is a threshold. As far down as they've been able to study, they have been able to find some effect.
I'm sorry, did you have a follow-up, Senator?
Well, I think just to make sure I understood the last statement, so there's no safe level of lead. At least according to science.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, lead is a substance for which there is documented effects at virtually the lowest measurable levels.
On the North Dakota sample, do you recall a difference at all in lead levels between the people from, say, Fargo and the people from Dickinson? For example, this would be kind of a city, more rural difference.
Mr. Chair, we're checking. I don't know the answer to that question. We'll look and get back to you on that.
All right.
If there's a difference between I'm assuming you mean the Fargo residents as compared to the Jamestown,
right.
Dickinson. All right.
Right.
Chair, I did not see that they included that in their tables, but I will check and see if they
just a curiosity.
Described it.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your testimony. Next on the agenda is Dr. Heidi Kassenborg from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Dr. Heidi Kassenborg. I'm the Division Director for the Dairy and Food Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. I have a question first. I know there was a question about peanut butter. I'm not sure which order you would like me to proceed.
If you want me to go with
the peanut butter or the venison.
If it's
issue.
A brief explanation, go ahead and deal with the peanut butter.
I think it was Senator Stumpf. That was your question. Could you repeat your question, please?
Senator Stumpf.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Kassenbaum?
Kassenborg,
okay. In the news that covered that story, it said that when you traced it back to the company that had that produced the peanut butter that had the salmonella in it, that actually a year before it ever identified a salmonella problem, they had already identified that salmonella was in the plant, and I was wondering why something wasn't done to prevent the impact on hundreds of thousands of people a year earlier.
Chairman, that's a very good question. They sent out the report from FDA's inspection report today to all the states, and there was something that's known as lab shopping that was going on. They were testing their product, finding a positive, then doing more tests and finding another laboratory to have it be negative, and then shipping that product. So that's what the company was doing, according to the records by FDA.
And Mr. Chairman and Doctor, I assume that these tests were run in approved labs?
They were done by private laboratories, Senator Stump, private laboratories.
Mr. Chairman, do private labs have to be approved or not?
They can, Senator Stump, private laboratories can run approved methods. So they can use the same methods as what would be done by an FDA laboratory or a state laboratory.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
In 2007 and 2008 program year for the donated venison program, when we became aware of the situation in North Dakota, we found lead in 32% of 239 samples that we collected. And some of those samples contain high levels of lead. When we looked at the situation further, and we found metal in 22% of 1,239 samples collected from 39 processors. And the percent of samples with metal evidence varied by individual processor. It ranged from 0 to 77%. Ground product had a higher rate of metal contamination. It was at 26% when compared to not ground product, which was at 2%. So that when we say not ground product, we also call that whole meat cuts. When we looked at it in the laboratory, the metal that our laboratory examined was all lead. There was no all of the metal that we looked at was confirmed as lead. In those packages that were looked at, lead concentration was variable, and some samples exceeded 100 parts per million. This year, or a program year, we found X-ray evidence of lead in 5% of samples tested, and that was limiting. The only thing that could be donated this year was whole meat cuts. We did not allow ground meat this year. And this was higher than the rate in 2007. In 2007, it was 2%. In response to this contamination, all venison processed for donation was collected or is in the process of being collected and tested for metal by X-ray prior to distribution. To date, about 6% of those products have had evidence of lead. Laboratory testing so far is not complete, but initial results of testing show large numbers of fragments in some of those packages. With that, I will open it up for any questions.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me how many meat producers started out the program before the lead situation, and how many we have now in the state of Minnesota for food shelves? You know how many there were?
Yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen, there were 70 processors last year for the program year of 2007-2008. This year, there were 35.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And the reason that it would have dropped in half like that, but what would be your... Well, what would the excuses they use to drop? not participate any longer? Was it because of the regulations and the testing that was done or things like that? Can you give me an idea?
Dr. Kassenbarg.
Yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen. One of the things we did this year to try to minimize lead contamination in the venison was to require the processors to attend an educational session that was conducted by ourselves and the University of Minnesota Meat Lab. And so we required them to do that in order to minimize the amount of lead contamination in the venison carcasses.
Are there a growing number of processors that are taking the class now? Imagine that there was a big drop-off with the requirement, which I think is good. But then has that number been steadily increasing?
Chairman Chowdhury, that's a difficult question to answer because we're not doing, since the venison season's over with, we're not conducting any more training sessions. We're depending upon what happens, we're not doing it at this point, so it's really can't answer that at this time.
Okay. When would you presumably then resume them?
That depends upon discussions that we'll have to have about the venison program.
So those decisions haven't been made. The venison program continues. When would you resume your classes so that more processors can participate?
As soon as the decisions are made at a policy level, we would resume those as soon as practical.
Is the department reviewing whether the venison program should exist?
That is not something that is strictly with the Department of Agriculture. That is something that has to do with the Department of Natural Resources and Health as well.
I'm just asking if the Department of Agriculture is having that discussion.
I will refer to our policy chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Quinn Sheeney. I'm the policy director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And just to respond to that question, I believe it was last year, or two years ago, the venison donation program was started by the legislature, and we have carried out the program. All of this is about the discussion as it has changed over the years. We have had a couple of meetings at the request of House members, and I think that is what Dr. Kassenbarg is referring to. So the department will continue to operate the program as is directed by statute, but there are other members who have requested information on how to change the program going forward.
All right. So the department is interested in whether the legislature will make changes to it or not. And
we're not advocating, Mr. Chair, any changes to the program. Okay. We'll just...
All right. Thank you for clarifying. Who is next? Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chairman, I have just one quick question. About how many pounds of meat were distributed through the food shelves?
I can we'll pull that data up right now.
Mr. Chairman, as she's looking for that, it would seem to me that would be one of the key factors of whether or not the program continues is how many people got good meat as a result of the program.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that's kind of skewed because a lot of it was taken off the shelves. I mean, well, I thought I heard that all of it was under this concern. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, last year, we did not know about the situation with the contamination until March.
Okay.
So we weren't able to pull that product off.
Okay.
In response to
Senator Fredrickson's
question, in 2007, there were 78,000 pounds processed.
278,000?
No, 78,500. And that constitutes 1,996 deer carcasses. In 2008, we have approximately 700, with approximately 20,000 pounds of deer or venison processed.
How many pounds in 08 again?
Approximately 20,000 okay. at this point.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Kassenberg, the 20,000 pounds, that is processed meat ready to be given to the consumer. That isn't the raw weight of the deer. That's the processed weight?
Processed weight.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned about X-raying it. Was all of that X-rayed? Or was it just test samples that you X-rayed and pulled the contaminated meat from circulation?
Dr. Kassenberg.
Senator Olson, that was processed weight. And we did pull out approximately 6% of that was contaminated, and that was destroyed.
So Mr. Chairman, Dr. Kasselberg, so you did X-ray all processed meat that went to food shelves and removed that before it went this year?
Dr. Kasselberg.
Senator Olson, that is correct. We did X-ray all that product before it went to food shelves this year.
Thank you.
Go ahead, and Senator Egbertson, and then...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions, then. I'd like to know what the cost of that would be to the state of Minnesota, the X-raying that, and also a question directed to Quinn, if I could. How far do the... where are the training sessions? Are they statewide, or meat processors, who I understand are doing it for not a whole lot of profit, how far do they have to travel for this kind of training?
To either of you, who can answer?
Senator, cost-wise, per pound in 2007, cost per pound for processor reimbursement only was $1.78 per pound of venison. And this year, with the additional X-ray costs, it was approximately $2.45 a pound. Now, the locations of those training sessions were, one was within University of Minnesota's meat lab. There was another one, and then there was two other ones that were held outstate. One was in, I believe, Grand Rapids, and the other one was down in the Rochester area. One of the things we did was to survey the interest in that and tried to coordinate it at a central location for the processors that were interested.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious if you heard the testimony from the first person who was speaking. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, who was giving the presentation and showed how the lead distributes throughout the meat.
Mr. Cornicelli.
Thank you. And so I was curious if, and I understand that you X-ray it now, but if you have any thoughts about whether you're really picking up all of the lead that could potentially be in it based on what he said. Because my understanding of what he said was that some of the lead may not show up on an X-ray, or it may be hard to distinguish, to see very clearly, but it could still be in the meat. Or is there any other way that you're testing it? Or doing random samples to see after you X-ray it if all the lead is out of it?
I thought I heard what Mr. Cornicelli said was that it would be hard to see with the naked eye what the X-ray detected, but the X-ray itself, the size of the X-ray was not long enough to get the whole carcass. And that's why the X-ray, although it probably had most of it, didn't have the entirety of it, just because the X-ray itself wasn't wide enough. I thought that's what I heard.
Okay,
Mr. Cornicelli said.
Even if that's the case, my question would be then, after you X-ray the meat, is there any analysis of random samples of the meat to see if the lead is removed from a cut piece of meat?
Dr. Kassenborg.
Senator, that's an excellent question. The X-ray will detect 0.8 millimeters in size of fragments. We have attempted to look at, our laboratory is doing some analysis of some of the packages of venison that were negative on X-ray, but we do not have the results of that testing yet.
And then my question earlier to you was that I asked the Department of Health, but is more directed to you, is so I guess my understanding would be is since you're operating under the assumption that because you're using the cut pieces of meat and not ground meat, that there isn't lead in it. So then, or maybe you're looking at me like that was wrong. But what I was going to say is then, so do you have any special packaging or advisory that goes on the meat that is distributed to the food shelves so that people who, women who are pregnant or young children don't eat it anyway? Or is that not an issue if it's taken out of, if it's not in the meat that you've examined? So Dr. my Kassenberg. Question really is, what about the labeling for targeted populations?
The food shelves were instructed to accompany the packages of meat with some information about restrictions on who should not, as determined by the Department of Health, those advisories about pregnant women and young children not consuming venison. So those packages were supposed to be accompanied when they were picked up at the food shelf.
Each piece of each package, or not just post. I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if there's a general advisory similar to fish consumption that might be posted near a lake, or if it's actually attached to each package of processed meat. Or you don't know,
Senator. I can't say that each package, but that they were supposed to go with.
To each client.
To each client. I can't say that each individual package had a statement with it. But if they got a quantity of venison, then that quantity of venison would be accompanied by labeling.
That's great. Thank you.
Do food shelves take fish donations, too?
Dr.
Kassenberg?
No, they're not. Fish donations are not allowed.
What about just general fish in general, aside from fish being caught and donated?
Senator, Chair, if it is a product that can be sold in the grocery store and the same food safety handling practices are maintained, then it can go to the food shelves.
Do those have advisories for young children and pregnant women?
Each individual package does not have an advisory.
In any advisory, does it have any advisory? If it's a fish product, does it have any sort of advisory for pregnant women or young children?
Chairman, I can't answer that question. I don't know.
Did anyone else have their hand up? Senator Stump and then Scobie. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, I'm just sitting here thinking that if you've, you know, I'm trying to visualize 0.8 millimeters, and, you know, what is that? How big is it and how much? I mean, give us an idea what size that would be.
Dr. Kassenberg, how do we visualize 0.8 millimeters? Is that a pinhead or less than a pinhead? What?
Senator, that's a pinhead size. But the range of those are up to pea-sized. We did see up to pea-sized fragments of lead in those packages.
So, Mr. Chairman, in the presentation from the Department of Natural Resources, they were basically saying that specks that would not be visual to an ordinary person would be picked up by the X-ray. I think I could see a speck the size of a pinhead, but that doesn't seem like a very efficient, you know, way of picking up those pieces of lead. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that if we use tools to identify and eliminate the lead out of this the meat that's made available, and then put warnings on it that children and women, or maybe it's just pregnant women, shouldn't eat it. I mean, who else goes to the food shelf? Basically, it's families. I mean, we've done what we can to try to eliminate the lead, and then we've more than cut in half the processors and almost a third less, no, two-thirds less meat made available. I mean, pretty soon the program's not going to be worth keeping in place. We're spending $2.45 a pound. I'm just thinking that maybe we're over-regulating to the point where we're trying to regulate the program right out of existence. It's more of a comment.
The question I had on your the document that you passed out,
the question I was asking,
Dr. Kassenberg, was that
this is the question I was reading.
Lead was found in 32% of samples. It's at the top of your page. And some samples contained high levels of lead. So what percent of the 32% was high levels of lead, and what do you consider high?
Chairman, we didn't analyze it to that degree. We didn't put them into high levels. We don't know. We didn't examine it to that degree, but some of them had almost 1,000 milligrams per 400 grams of product. So there was some of those packages did have pretty high levels, and it was quite variable.
So when you say some, I mean, I want to get the correct impression from your statement. Lead was found in 32%, but then you said some samples had high levels of lead. So some people are going to walk away with the impression that 32% of what you tested had high levels of lead. So what is the real answer? Are we talking about a common practice where you found 1,000 parts per whatever the unit you said in 32% of the samples? Or is that just an anecdote of how extreme it got once in a while?
Point of that particular comment on there was to illustrate that if a person were to consume that particular package, high levels of lead could be consumed. The distribution of the levels of lead on those packages was from very little to 1,000 milligrams, and so it was pretty evenly distributed throughout that 34%.
And then you indicated that the ground product had a higher rate of contamination than whole cuts. Did the Department of Agriculture, or was the Department of Agriculture able to discern anything about the processing of meat from that difference?
Senator, one of the things with grinding of venison is that it's done in batches. Several carcasses can be ground at the same time. And so pieces of lead that may be in one animal or one part then can be distributed throughout other packages of ground product. So that's the likely way that all those packages got contaminated.
As I'm looking back to the x-rays that Mr. Cornicelli showed us, and I'm not gathering, and maybe I'm wrong, I'm not gathering that there was a 1,000 milligrams of lead contained in any part of their carcass other than possibly the initial 2 inches surrounding the wound. Do you have any thoughts on that? Where would you normally find 1,000 parts on a carcass?
It would be mostly within that radius of the near the wound channel. As you saw on those x-rays, that's where most of the lead was located. There are scraps, or there are pieces of venison that do go into ground product. They try to trim as much as they can out of there, but sometimes there are pieces that do contain larger pieces of metal.
I'm just trying to figure out, from your experience, Dr. Kassenberg, how, with the, even if there was distribution of lead fragments amongst a carcass, how you could end up with that type of concentration in one packet. Walk me through that. What type of scenario would have to occur for that type of concentration to happen?
A piece of metal would have had to have been put in with a grinder and then resulted in put into the package of meat. I guess I'm not clear about any other way that that could happen.
And would that type of concentration of lead likely have come from that initial 2 inch of exit wound?
Senator, we
not
don't know
for sure, but quite possibly.
It's possible, but as you saw, there's a lot of fragments that are further away from that 2 inches.
But I'm trying to figure out how you would, from that type of spread, from what the x-rays we've seen, how you would end up with 1,000
grind it up
milligrams in
grind it up
in a whole in that entire is there that much that can spread 1,000 milligrams worth outside of the 2 inches or 5 inches or 6 inches that you can get that type of concentration?
You know, Senator, I'm not a ballistics expert,
okay. So
I really can't comment on the intricacies of the fragmentation of those bullets.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I don't know who can answer this question, but some of them I think go to Mr. Cornicelli and possibly to the doctor on the bullet as to the instructions or the training that you give to the processors, but. You identified several bullets that actually the fragmentation was quite minimal. Do they tend to be more expensive bullets, or how widespread is their use? And is there, in the process of the training of processors, do they ever ask, or would that be something to ask as to what type of bullet was used in the taking of that animal, because some of them are, have a good shot, a good chance of being rather minimally contaminated with the metal fragments, where others, it was quite extensive. Could you, I've kind of mixed a few thoughts here, but maybe you could help respond to that notion.
Mr. Cornicelli. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, Lou Cornicelli, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Yes, the cost differential is about twice, give or take commodity prices and so on. The cost of the cheapest bullet we used was that Remington Core-Lock, and they run $20 a box. The other bullets are all pretty comparable, $35 to $45 a box of 20. So they are about twice the price for the more premium lines of bullets like that Barnes bullet.
So that they still contain lead, but they tend not to fragment, and they're about twice the cost.
Some of them, yeah. Even the ones like the Interbond Hornady bullet that we shot is an expensive bullet, and it fragmented. The Barnes bullet was an expensive bullet, but it did not fragment. So it really comes down to bullet design, probably more than cost, although I'll probably be corrected in some point in the future. So we did see that variance, even though the price may or may not be more. Dr. Kassenborg can fill in the details, but we did ask this year what type of bullet was used, whether it was a shotgun muzzleloader, lead-based bullet, copper-based bullet, at the time the hunter donated the deer. And I donated a deer, and I got that same form, and it was fairly simple to fill out. So we did get a sense. I haven't seen the data yet, but we did get a sense for what percentage of deer were donated with copper-based versus lead-based slugs. And I don't know if I answered the whole question. The music kind of drowned out
But I wondered if that information was available to processors, too, in terms of their how they handle and what would be communicated. Because it would seem to me that if there was a minimal or virtually non-existent within the meat, you could also save the money of having to X-ray if you had confidence in what had happened prior to your handling of it.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, we showed a little bit longer version of that PowerPoint that I showed at the processor training, so they all saw the different bullet types and the results. I actually showed them more X-rays than I showed you all just for time. And they also, so they had a, plus the training session with a processor showing them kind of maybe ways to minimize. They were also, what we did miss in all of our talking was we did tell them to use more discretion. You know, if you find a carcass that has excessive bullet wounds, reject it. You know, don't take it at all. And once they saw the pictures on the X-ray, especially those hindquarter shots, it was pretty visual for them. Yeah. So I think the processors did, at least at the training, they got all the information that we had available at the time, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Kassenberg, are wild game processors commonly inspected, as are other meat processors?
Senator, yes, the processors are inspected. For the ones that were in the venison donation program, they are inspected quarterly. They're called custom meat processors, and they are inspected for sanitation. That differs from the meat that you get in the grocery store. That product, the animal has to actually be inspected before and after slaughter.
And that has always been the case, the custom, what was the name of it, the custom?
Custom slaughter, yes.
The custom slaughter operations. This is, you know, your local meat store that we often take our wild game to process. They've always been inspected quarterly for sanitation.
There is one exception to that. It's venison processing. If you do not do anything other than cut up the venison, then you're not inspected. If you don't add anything to it, if you don't make any meat out of it, then those entities exist, but only to cut up the actual carcass. They can't add any, they can't make sausage, they can't make jerky or anything like that. And so that's just an entity that happens during hunting season. None of those types were allowed to donate venison to the food shelves.
Can they grind meat as well?
Yes.
So some of these folks can they can process meat, they can grind it. They don't have to be inspected, but they've never been allowed into the program anyway.
Correct.
Is that correct?
They're not allowed in the program, no. Correct.
Now or before?
Neither before nor now.
Okay. But the ones that are inspected, they can grind, do all that. Their meat, however, is not inspected. They're inspected for sanitation.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Are they inspected for meat now? Is their meat inspected now, the participants in the venison donation program?
Senator, I'm not sure what your question is. Is the meat that goes into the food shelves inspected? Is that your question?
Correct.
There is no inspector present when the meat for the venison donation program is processed. They are only inspected for sanitation.
However, is all the meat that is going to food shelves, is that now X-rayed or just samples?
Senator, all the meat was X-rayed before it went to the food shelves.
Is that something the department feels it should continue? Or is it examining some other form of accountability?
Senator, that's not something we have made a decision on.
How much did the department spend on x-rays, x-raying this last round?
Senator, it increased the cost per pound for a reimbursement from $1.78 to $2.45 per pound.
So how much was that? Did that translate to?
I can't do that in my head very well. So I will have to give you...
Is it 20,000 pounds?
Yeah, so it's 20,000 pounds. Roughly $20,000.
Okay. I'll get back to that. Senator Olson, you had your hand up.
Yes,
Senator,
I just said... I appreciate the sheet that you had on tips for hunters, because we've been focusing on what goes to the food shelf.
All right.
But this affects those who keep the meat and feed their family with it as well.
Okay.
So I think it is important information for anybody hunting and using the meat to understand and know this. So is that something being communicated to all hunters, tips on this? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, we put some basic information in our regulations book at the time that we could, which is July, when the book goes to press. We also posted that tips information on our website, along with some other lead information, like the presentation you saw, and some other data. So yes, we made that as widely available as we could on our website and through our normal outlets.
And Mr. Chair, the tips on bows aren't lead, are they? Or are they?
Mr. Cronicelli.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, no, archery equipment is different.
So that's the safe bet for.
Mr. Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize because I was called out for a minute if this has already been answered. But Dr. Kassenberg, obviously if I go out and shoot a deer and have a process and eat it, that's kind of my own free will. But what happens with this program if it's determined that somebody does get lead poisoning, who's liable?
Dr. Kassenberg.
Senator, I can, because we are reimbursing the processors for that product, for the processing, the state of Minnesota owns that product. So I would assume, because of our ownership and our involvement, that could open us up for liability.
Just a follow-up. I don't know, do we ask for proof of insurance from the processor? And if a processor doesn't do a good job of... processing the deer, and that effect. I mean, I'm not trying to, but I do think that if that's what our ultimate question is here, is if we are doing something dangerous, and assuming it's resulting in lead poisoning, that we ought to know who's liable.
Did you have a response to that, Dr. Kassenberg?
As I said, that product would be the property of the Minnesota taxpayers, and as such, they would be responsible for it being in the food shelves.
Thank you.
Our processors whose meat has been rejected reimbursed nonetheless?
Yes, the processors have been reimbursed for any of the product that they had donated to them, regardless of contamination.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you have to worry too much about that, because the cuts I'm going to have to make to ag, you're not going to have any money to do any inspecting anyways. You're going to have to get that to the Deer Hunter Association or something, because ag can't afford anymore. My cuts. I'm going to have to do it. It's the sauce. I've been eating deer since I was 10, and I won't tell you my age, but it's been 65, better 67 years ago. Hell, I never been sick in my life. My kids all eat it. We get into this big idea now, well, you can't, lead hurts you. This hurts you, and that hurts you. Whatever happened to common sense in this place? We go deer hunting. I don't eat any. I cut that out myself. I wouldn't eat a piece of mashed up bloody. I cut that out. I don't care if I end up with just a handful of meat, but I want it to be nice, clean meat. And so, you know, we got to start using a little common sense around this place and kind of take care of yourself.
Yeah, and I think this I think it's fair to ask the same question about labeling for fruits and vegetables being washed, contents of fatty acid foods, foods with high concentrations of high fructose corn syrup, which have also been linked to a lot of future physical ailments. So if we're going to ask the question about lead, then I think it's fair to ask the question about some of these other substances as well. And I don't know what, maybe there is an answer, but I think the question is fair. I'm trying to figure out in my mind how we got from no negligible increase in blood levels for people who eat wild game to some samples having high content of lead in the venison donation program. I'm not questioning the research. I'm just questioning what happened in between. And that, I think, concerns me. And it would be interesting to know what did happen. I don't think you, Senator Vickerman, take the meat from the exit wound and grind it up into hamburger. I don't think you do. I think you'd
end up with, if I end up with just 5 pounds out of a big deer, that's enough. But that meat's going to be cut. That meat's going to be, I'm take the best. Now, when I see here, well, what do you do with it? If you shoot a deer, you know that, and it's kind of shot up, you can't throw it in the ditch. You got to do something with it, or the game warden will fine you for wanton waste of game. So we're kind of getting two different things. We got deer last year and donated them to the food shelf. They were processed up in Park Rapids. I think they were. I don't know what they did with them, but that's where we left them. And for the simple reason, what's going on here? You could shoot five deer up those. Where we hunt, you can shoot five deer. Who needs five deer? You're lucky if you one between three or four of us. That's all we do. Because it's $200 and some to process a deer. How many of them are you going to do? So maybe we better look at our laws and go back and say, let's not be allowing somebody to shoot. People shot them just to be doing it, as long as they could donate to me. I don't know if I think that's wrong.
Maybe it would be helpful to the ag budget if the department did not have to reimburse for meat that's rejected. And maybe that would help processors be more careful on what meat is donated to our food shelves. Just wondering out loud. Further questions or comments? I really appreciate the DNR and the Department of Health and the Department of Agriculture for the information that they presented today and for answering all the questions to the best of their ability and so candidly. All three departments have clearly taken this issue seriously, and I think these three departments taking the issue so seriously has led to some important answers, maybe led to some other questions, but at least we know, have a better idea of where to, which questions to ask. But I think you've provided some excellent information today, and we thank you. If there are no other comments or questions from the committee, the meeting is adjourned.
Yep, I'll be out there.
That's right.